Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:28 p.m. Pacific Summer Time, and today is May 12th, and I apologize for recording the audio a bit later. I've been having the same problems that I had last week, and that has catalyzed my decision. I just have to buy a new computer. This one, I think, is obviously reaching the end of its useful life. This has been a reasonably, and of course, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio. So this has been a reasonably uneventful week. Wall Street has been pretty much going sideways. The majority of Europe, which had got right back up to test the 2015 highs on that Eurostoxx index, it's a little bit overbought and it has at least paused. We saw the first evidence, and I think perhaps we should look at that first. We saw the first evidence today of some support coming back into the Chinese market. It has been pulling back on consecutive weeks, and it has now bounced from the region of the 3200 area and the region of the January low, but it is being led higher by the banks. And I think the banks, the fact that they are beginning to find support here, and that this was a very clear upward dynamic, that at least begins to confirm that they are going to get some support, that they are not going to be allowed to come under increasing pressure. I think there's a lot of mixed signals coming out of China, because they are still stimulating the economy through fiscal stimulus. What they are doing is tightening on the monetary front, most particularly to put pressure on the shadow banking sector or private lending clubs, or how they euphemistically call them is Chinese hedge funds. And that is part of the reason that some of the leverage has come out of the stock market, most particularly the banks, because the banks have come under pressure. They have been told they're not allowed to stop lending, but they have been under pressure from higher costs. So this upper dynamic is really very encouraging. And it does suggest that indices like the H shares in Hong Kong should be able to improve upon their performance. It has bounced from the region of that 10,000 level and the region of the 200-day moving average, and it is doing a bit better. And by and large, this looks like a reasonably consistent staircase step sequence uptrend. Although we can see from that 10-year chart that it is coming off reasonably depressed levels, and it isn't even halfway through the larger range just yet. I think that when we then go back and look at the Dow gold ratio and begin to frame the discussion in terms of what we might expect from the long term, I think this index is a very good frame of reference, because it gives us the relationship of two major asset classes over 100 years. And what I find particularly interesting is the consistency of the distance between the peaks. They're between 35 and 34 years. And since the last peak was in 1999, and if this cycle is going to remain consistent, then the next peak will be above 40, and it will probably occur sometime around 2034 or 2033. But how do we get there from here? Because if it goes above 40, then this index would, or this ratio would have to double, and that's quite an ask. Now, there's only two ways it could double. Well, I guess there are a mix of ways, but the easy two ways would be for gold to halve, or for the Dow to double, and we could have a mix of both. That the Dow could go up less, or it could go up more, and gold could go up or down from here. But perhaps the more important point is that there would have to be some really profound changes in how the global economy functions in order to get us to a Dow gold ratio of 45. And let's try and imagine what those might be. Because I think, you know, this might have been an inert week, but I started writing another book. I think that there are a sufficiently large number of additional themes that And there is a great deal of complication with how they're all going to interact, that is, I think, going to create more of a tapestry than a monochromatic way of looking at the world. Because I think your veteran subscribers will be familiar with the themes that we have been elucidating up upon for the better part of a decade already, and these are that the rapid pace of technological innovation, the fact that energy prices are going to remain low for the foreseeable future, and that the rise of the global consumer is going to create massive new markets. But against that background, we also have the fact that inflation is very, very low. It has been going down for 35 years, so there is the real possibility that inflation is going to represent a significant theme in the next 20 years. And then I've been rereading Plato's Republic, and most particularly the chapters around the way that human society forms. And I think we have at least some evidence of oligarchy, democracy, and tyranny in the world today. And certainly we don't see that history rhymes, and that these were never historical in the first place, that they were merely ways of thinking about society. But what we certainly have had in the last year has been a massive change in the status quo. And to me at least, I think of myself as a libertarian. I don't feel that I have the right or indeed the inclination to tell anybody how they should live their lives. But by the same token, I don't feel like being told by anyone else how I should live mine. And certainly that is how I have lived my life. But I think that the other way of thinking about it is that libertarianism can also be construed as licentiousness or wantonness, and that there is ample evidence of those trends also evolving. And one of the things that Plato talks about, and I find it fascinating that despite the fact that we are separated by thousands of years, that humans don't change, that we that then that is why crowd psychology works, that the technological advantage that we have today means a lot in terms of our quality of life, but it doesn't change the fact that we are human. And one of the things that he describes as a democracy is really the rise of liberalism. And we have had a massive evolution in liberalism in the last 50 years, and that is potentially coming to an end. That we are, and the media has, in I think, the media has characterized this as the rise of populism, but I think more correctly it is revolution. And what we are seeing is that the status quo is being replaced by what Plato would describe as tyrants. And he even goes so far as to say that tyrants are always welcomed in, that they are always seen as the hero of the common man. And that is particularly true of Trump. It is certainly it played a role in the decision of the UK to leave the EU. I would have voted the same way personally, not least because with Macron now in the Elysee Palace, that and he is also representative of the elite, but has been chosen as the savior of the common man, and he is going for the well, he is already proposing that there should be a fiscal union in Europe. He's also suggesting that there should be a reform of the European Parliament. Now, that's an enormous question because the European Parliament, such as it is organized right now, is not what one could describe as a model of democracy. And that would have to change. If it does not change, if it does not change to allow greater participation and suffrage for the people of Europe, well then, what other way do we have to describe it then as either an oligarchy or a tyranny? So I think that these are important topics that need to be discussed because what happens on the political front and is going to have an impact on markets. But the fact that it has changed so much means that it is going to have an effect on markets that has been, I think, we haven't seen in a long time. That the likelihood is that we're going to have a fiscal response, and that that's increasingly likely. It might be difficult to pass in the US, but it is likely, and then it is also likely to be a factor in Europe. That if we talk about fiscal union, then what Europe is really talking about is fiscal transfers, and that is really a hot potato politically, and whether that can be affected is open to question. But I don't think it is really a question of if, but rather when. Australia voted this week, or didn't vote, excuse me. The Australian budget this week included a 60 billion stimulus, which is assuming that there is going to be rapid wage growth. And wage growth is one of the things that could really help to catalyze the way that people are thinking about various issues. Now, let me see if I can find this chart. I think that this chart, it's from the, I think it's from the Harvard's Business Review. And I must try and find one that is more up to date. But it shows us the sharp delineation that that median family income, private consumption, that the real GDP per capita and labor productivity trended higher together until about the 1980s. And then we had this divergence, and the divergence has got increasingly wide over time. This chart, more than anything else, I think, helps to identify what the problem is and where the potential solution is, that people are going to vote for anything that will improve their standards of living in the short term. Liberalism has been able to deliver on universal suffrage, universal education, social security, and in many countries, universal healthcare. And now that's just not enough, that the cost of living has increased, and that people not only want more, but they need more to survive, because the cost of education that has increased. Basic education might be free, but in many respects, basic education is useless. That because of technological innovation, that an advanced degree or post-secondary education or training is essential. And at the moment, it is quite expensive. And that is something that is probably going to have to change if more people are going to be brought out of long-term unemployment, or the potential for long-term unemployment, because we're at a very important point right now where technological innovation is accelerating, and the rise of the robot, the rise of automation and artificial intelligence is pricing an increasing number of people out of the labor market. And what do they do with themselves? That then there is the demographic issue. So in addition to the fact that you have this sea change politically, you have this difference that some people have referred to as generation wars. One of the most important statistics is that the most populous age group in the US today are 26-year-olds. By the time the next election comes around, they'll be 30. And then they'll be at prime family formation age. At that point, are they going to vote for Trump or potentially Mark Zuckerberg? So, or some other high-profile media candidate? That is a very real possibility. And what is the answer going to be? Well, the answer is going to be deadlock. That we already see that what people are voting for is a person of change, but what you get is political parties that still have vested interests. And this is the kind of environment where that if the people do not get what they want, they will vote for progressively more extreme candidates. And if a number of countries are doing that, that nationalism is one of the most effective tools for maintaining the cohesion of a country. The Chinese know that very well, and Chinese nationalism is increasing. So we cannot rule out the possibility that the logical conclusion, however long it may take, of the revolution that we're getting in the status quo is war. That needn't necessarily be in this decade, but that it is likely at some point in the future. So these are additional themes that, in addition to the rise of the global consumer, the lower price of oil, the lower price of energy, I should say, and the rapid pace of technological innovation, whether that is in batteries, transportation, chemistry, and biotechnology, that not only are those going to enhance the standard of living of the people who can afford them, but they will filter down. The majority of population growth is going to happen in Africa. There are rapid advances being made in combating malaria. By some estimations, more people have died from malaria than just about anything else. And we already know that the global birth rate has peaked, but the population continues to increase because of improvements in mortality rates, infant mortality rates most particularly. If malaria is controlled and infant mortality rates improve, then the chances are that the population increases. And Africa has a very young population, and Europe has a very old population. What is Europe going to do to encourage its economic growth, not least when it has such an aging population? Then they're going to have to figure out a way either to go for greater automation, greater productivity per worker, and they may not have a choice in the number of refugees that they take. A large number of the Syrian refugees are not going to leave. A large number of the people that came with the Syrian refugees are from Africa. And once they have created a foothold, they'll be sending for their families. So the logical outcome is that Africa will begin to benefit increasingly from remittances. It'll benefit from the fact that the diseases that have hampered growth for years will start to be brought under control. And it will also benefit from skipping whole stages in terms of its economic development. But what it needs is education. That in order to enhance individual productivity, then physical skills are going to be less required than technical skills and indeed academic skills. And those are some of the greatest challenges that are standing out there right now. There are two charts that I think are quite interesting. I found this one on a Morgan Stanley report, and it's 20 megs So I'm going to post it on Monday, and I hope you'll be able to download it, but it's a very large file. And it's an estimation of where the price of oil is going to be in 2025. And you can see that there's a magic $60 level. And $60 is about where it is today. There has been some significant rationalization in the energy sector, and that is being shown in the ability of companies to produce. And the big estimation is that unconventional shale oil in the US could contribute an additional 4 million barrels a day. An additional 4 million barrels a day for US crude in an environment where demand is peaking, and that is a realistic possibility, would make the US energy independent, or at least oil independent. Because it isn't just oil. I found this to be a very interesting chart. We can see that total energy demand in 2015 was this little globe up on the left. And the big potential is solar. Solar technology is improving rapidly. Every time a technology becomes commercial, then the price of it just trends lower very quickly afterwards. So, solar is the big bet on where we can get real productivity growth. But the enhancements in solar are dependent on technology. The low risk bet is geothermal. Geothermal represents really quite a small contributor to global energy today. But with hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, and the fact that these drills have the capability to go miles underground, then we have the relatively cheap possibility of massively increasing the amount of geothermal energy that we require, or that we can get. And that doesn't require any enhancements in technology, because it's more than available with today's technology. Now, that is something that I don't see has been considered by many people at all. And we can see that this green line here represents the potential for geothermal energy. So we're talking multiples, a massive sea change in the ability of the global economy to power itself. So we could have lower energy prices for the foreseeable future. The fact that this is not limited to any one country means that we could have geothermal being set up anywhere, because drilling today is limited to where oil resources are. But if we're simply going down for depth so that we can set up heat exchangers, then you could drill anywhere. And that is particularly good news for energy importers. So, there is a very real prospect that energy prices could be going sideways for the lengthy medium term. That doesn't mean that they won't spike higher on geopolitical tensions, that if Venezuela does in fact default and CDS spreads are around 40% right now, well then, we're going to get a higher oil price. But it isn't a question of how high the oil price will go in such an event, but rather how long it can be sustained. There is the potential that if the US becomes truly energy independent, then why do they need to ensure the security of the Middle East? And then we have th there is the potential for real trouble, that we were perhaps only getting a taster for just how volatile that region can get. And Saudi Arabia and Iran are already fighting proxy wars on three fronts, and there is the potential that that could just devolve into an outright war between the two. So there is the potential that because of technological innovation and low energy prices, that not only have we begun to see the change in the status quo, but that rather there is the potential for that change to mushroom, and that we are going to have very profound changes, that there is no way that we can still talk about the world in a monochromatic sense, that it is a tapestry, and that these trends, these themes are going to affect different countries in different ways. And that's why I want to write another book, because I think that it is going to require time to really analyze exactly what we can expect. But the charts tell us that the most likely outcome is that we are going to be in a secular bull market for at least the next 15 to 17 years. And that means that pullbacks, and there will be pullbacks, can be regarded as buying opportunities. That we are unlikely to have, according to the yield curve spread, we're unlikely to have a recession anytime in the next 2 years. But we do know that there is a great deal of debt that needs to be refinanced in the period from 2019 through 2022. And there is a trend where this spread has been contracting for the last 5 years, and it's been coming down from 300 basis points to currently 100 basis points. At some point, it's going to become inverted. We looked at the two-year yield, and if that does break out, well, then this and the 10-year yield does not also rise by the same pace, then we're going to get it increasingly close to inverting. But an inverted yield curve gives us upwards of a couple 18 months to 12 to 18 months of a warning for the next recession. So we have a short-term overbought condition in stock markets. We are leaving the most favorable time of the year for stocks. So there's the potential that we get a hiccup at some point over the summer, and that can be viewed as a buying opportunity within the context of a secular bull market. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.